Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I hope you remember our discussions about different types of mysticism in the previous two sessions, since we had a long break between this session and the previous one. If you remember, we mentioned that we have four types of inclinations in mystical thoughts: mysticism of fear, mysticism of renunciation, mysticism of love, and mysticism of gnosis, which is knowledge, ma'rifah. And we discussed about the three types of mysticism and their main proponents and Sufis who followed each attitude: fear, zuhd, and love. Now, just quickly look at those mystics who were following a mysticism of ma'rifah, meaning that they placed more emphasis on knowledge than love, or on than zuhd, renunciation. One Sufi I will only mention here, because there are many, many different Sufis and mystics here that if you want to pay attention to them, it will take a long, long time. Only the most prominent people in this field, Al-Hakim al-Tirmidhi. Of course, this is different Tirmidhi from the Tirmidhi who has written this Sahih of Tirmidhi. He was a mystic of the 3rd century, and since he was Hakim, means he was philosopher as well, so he was a mystic philosopher, and that's why he brought this idea of Gnostic emphasis in mysticism, rather than just emphasizing on renunciation and love. So his surname Al-Hakim, or his actually nickname or laqab, Al-Hakim means the philosopher, points to the fact that through him some Hellenistic philosophical ideas penetrated into Sufism, as we have it today as well. We have lots of new Platonic ideas in our theoretical mysticism, which have come through these people who were Sufis and philosophers, and were acquainted to lots of Hellenistic philosophical ideas, especially Plato. Plato and Plotinus, both of them, play a great, great role in shaping the theoretical outlook of Islamic mysticism, of course. And Tirmidhi's main contribution to the mystical theory is probably his Seal of the Saints, Khatamul Awliya, which, of course, then this topic of Khatamul Awliya, which was mentioned very roughly by Tirmidhi, was taken on later on very elaborately by Ibn Arabi. And he said, as we have Khatamul Anbiya, we have Khatamul Awliya as well. However, he didn't regard, say for example, Imam al-Asr to be Khatamul Awliya or Khatamul Awsiya. He said that there is a Khatam to the whole knowledge of mystics, and he regarded himself to be Khatamul Awliya. Somehow, maybe it was some sort of illusion or whatever, we cannot judge what he meant by this. But this Seal of the Saints, when he talked about this, then he started to mention the idea that are very familiar to us today, the Quds, the pivot or the pillar of the mystic knowledge that should exist at every age. You know that Sufis, in every tariqah, they have a Quds. Quds is a pole to which everyone should, on which everyone should rely, and to which everyone should turn. These ideas came very early in the 3rd century of mysticism, and it was mentioned in this book, Seal of the Saints, by Hakim al-Tirmidhi. So he, thus the leader of the Sufi hierarchy was Qut, or pole, or pivot, or Ghaus, help, which was another name which was given to him. According to him, the saints govern the universe. Now, again, something which is very close to Shia ideas of the power of A'imma alayhimu salam, that they have al-wilayatu takwiniyah, meaning that they have power over the world of creation, not only power over the world of Tashri, Al-Alam al-Tashri, Wirat al-Tashri'iyya, not only in the Alam of religion, in the world of religion, they have power in this. Now, of course, some of the ideas of Shi'is are influenced by the extremist views which was mentioned in this thing by these Sunnis. It's amazing that they thought about their saints in a way that we even do not think about our imams. They said that the saint is actually the vicegerent of Allah on the earth, the Quds, and he can do whatever he wants. The whole universe is under his control. He is Alamul Akbar, and the universe is Alamul Asghar, or vice versa, depending how they actually interpreted these two terms. The bigger world is the saints, and the smaller world is the universe, and it's all under his control. All these ideas you can notice came very early in mystical thought. So, according to him, the saints govern the universe. Certain groups of 300 saints are entrusted with various duties in maintaining the world order. It still exists. They say there is a Quds, and then there are Awtad, which are the pillars of the earth, four. Now here 307 he mentions. Then there are Abdal, which are 300, which again they control everything in this world. And if they do not exist, the world would perish. The same ideas that we have about Imam, but they take it to very, very extreme type of concept, which is not even acceptable by Shi'is. They were influenced by the Shi'is. They took this into very extreme. And then when we want to bring them back into the Shia world, we see that these ideas are very extreme. Even we do not regard some of these things for our A'imma alayhi wasalam or for the Prophet. Now, of course, this is a mysticism which is philosophized, which has been very close to a type of philosophical ideology. Also, like the Prophet's whose seal is Muhammad, peace be on him, the saints also have their own seal. And different saints thought of themselves to be the seal of all the saints. The degree of sainthood, as stated by Tirmidhi, are related to the degrees of illumination and gnosis reached by the Sufi. It's not a hierarchy of love. Now, this is very important because in the mysticism of love, the more love you have, the nearer you are, the closer you are to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Here, the more knowledge you have of Allah, the closer you are to the realm of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, some people have tried to actually make a compromise between these two views, saying that, well, where does love come from? It comes from ma'rifah, isn't it? The more you know God, the more you feel love for Him. The more you are away from Him, the more ignorant of God you are, less love you feel, or you do not feel any love at all. So, love is the outcome of ma'rifah, actually. And therefore, these two schools of mysticism of love and ma'rifah can come close to each other in this way. Also, his emphasis on gnosis, ma'rifah. In this term, agnostic comes from this as well, because gnosis and agnosis, which is the opposite of ma'rifah, those people who say we have no knowledge about God, we cannot find any knowledge about God, this was something which came right from the beginning of the discussions about God in philosophy and mysticism, prepares the way for later philosophical speculations. If you remember, at the beginning of our talk, we said that mystics somehow distinguish two types of knowledge, ma'rifah and ilm. And they say ma'rifah is knowledge of God, ilm is the knowledge of the universe. And with two different methods. Ma'rifah is gained through purification, ilm is gained through study and experience. Now, of course, this, as I said, is not a Quranic type of terminology. It is something which has come from Sufi. And the origin comes from this Hakim al-Tirmidhi, which actually distinguished between two types of knowledge. I think that's all I wanted to say about Hakim al-Tirmidhi. He was very important. I mentioned him because he was actually a turning point in bringing a type of theorization into mystical thought, which existed, the influence of which existed for a long time, and many of the ideas of Ibn Arabi, which is the culmination of mystical theorization, have come from Hakim al-Tirmidhi as well as others, of course. Now, are two great mystics of two different types of mysticism I want to discuss here, because you might come across these two names very much. These are the most famous mystics of the 3rd century. And mystics of two different types of mysticism, which has left its imprint on the future development of all mysticism as well. Bayazid al-Bistami, or Abu Yazid, which is usually called Bayazid in a more easy way of pronunciation, and Junayd al-Baghdadi, who is the culmination of the mysticism in the 3rd century, after which, of course, mysticism took a different path. Now, they represent two different types of mysticism. Mysticism of intoxication and mysticism of soberity, sokr and sahl. Now, some mystics, they were inclined to go into a world that they could lose themselves. They couldn't see anything but God. And they just talk and speak of Him rather than themselves. They wanted to somehow lose themselves in God and become intoxicated with this pleasant feeling of being annihilated in God. This is called mysticism of intoxication. And in lots of Persian poetry, of course, I don't know whether you have it in your own language, they talk about masti intoxication, that you reach intoxication when you leave all the bonds and attachments that you have in this world, and then you have that feeling, nice feeling of forgetting everything, but of course here for them Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, of course, mystics say, many mystics like Junayd say that this is only a primitive experience of God that you will have. And of course you will see the great mystics, which are very often mentioned in different books and are commended, because we human beings are inclined towards this intoxication. We like to lose everything and to only have the feeling and experience of God. That's because the mystics, that's why the mystics which represent this school of intoxication, I'm sure one of them you have heard very much, Mansur al-Hallaj. I'm sure all of you have heard of him, who was, of course, executed because of his very unacceptable statements that he made about his own self and his relation to God. He was one of those who was intoxicated by this experience of God. And usually he has become the role model of all those who are somehow feeling that they want to go towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, lose everything and sacrifice everything, offer everything for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. However, as we will see, the mystics like Junayd and people, of course, more advanced in mysticism regarded these as children in mysticism, regarded these people to be just primitive mystics who had lost themselves at the beginning steps of mystical experience. Now, let's look at both these, of course, Bayazid and Junayd, the representatives of these two schools. Now, Abu Yazid, he was born in Bastam, a small city in northwestern Iran. I don't think you can hear any mystic coming from any place other than Iran. I mean, Iran was a hotbed of this mystical these mystical experiences. And he formulated the experience of Fana, which of course is still, we discussed it, and still is a great concept in mysticism, annihilation. For the first time he spoke of this. You see, middle of the 3rd century and end of the 2nd century, this concept of annihilation and fana came into the Islamic mystical thought. And he was asked about renunciation. Now this is very interesting. He was asked, what is zuhd? We had that mysticism of zuhd and renunciation. He said, what is zuhd? Zuhd is nothing actually. He said, renunciation has no value because I am after intoxication, not renunciation. I was 3 days in renunciation. On the fourth day, I had finished it. Now, look how interestingly he speaks. The first day, I renounced this world. The second day, I renounced the other world. The third day, I renounced everything save God. Now, of course, these statements have no meaning for us because we don't have those experiences that these people had in their inner soul. What's the meaning of renouncing the other world? Meaning that they are not buying, they are not desiring anything but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Just, it reminds me of the statement of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam in Sahifa Sajjadiyah, that he said, oh God, if I had the capacity to be burnt into your hell, if I had that power and energy, I would have asked you to burn me in hellfire because I deserve it. But I don't have that capacity. So what should I do? And this is exactly the same thing, renouncing even the other world and thinking only about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So he said, on the second day I renounced the other world, the third day I renounced everything save God. When the fourth day came, nothing was left to me but God. I reached a desperate longing. Then I heard a voice addressing me. O Bayezid, you are not strong enough to endure with me alone. I said, that is exactly what I want. Then the voice said, you have found. Now, this loneliness of deserting everything that would have some sort of attachment to the soul, anything that comes out of our desires, of course, is something that not everyone can endure. So this is how he describes his own attitude towards zuhd. His famous shat are those statements, shathiyat are those statements which are made by Sufis when they are intoxicated. They lose control, and they only say things that they experience, but it doesn't make sense for us. It is sometimes translated as theopathetic statements, and something which the statements about God which are not right, of course, which are unhealthy, but it comes out of those instances which these mystics were in a type of excitement and ecstasy. So his famous shat, which has fascinated many mystics after him, was Subhani ma a'zama sha'ni, praise be to me, how great is my majesty. Now, of course, what this means is that I am God, isn't it? Subhani ma a'zama sha'ni, praise be to me, how great is my majesty, how great I am. The Sufis have tried to explain this very much, because this is very famous from Bayezid. And some of them have said that this is when Bayezid completely lost control and Allah was speaking from his tongue. And in fact, the same way as Allah was speaking from that tree of Musa alayhi salam, that Inni Anallah, of course the tree was saying, Inni Anallah, I am the Lord. And certainly we know that the tree was not Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah was speaking from the tree. The best explanation, which somehow exonerates these Sufis from saying funny things, is that he came to a situation that Allah was speaking from his tongue and was saying, Subhani ma a'zama sha'ni. Now, however, this is not accepted by many of those mystics who had the same experiences. They say that no, he came to a position that he lost himself. And he could not see himself, he only could see God. And he saw himself unified with God. And therefore,
when he looked at himself, he didn't see himself, he saw God, and then he said, Subhani ma'adama sha'ni. However, the difference between the two explanations are little. I mean, you come to a station, you come to a status that Allah would speak from your tongue, or you speak when you see the glory of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, while you have been removed out of the way, there is no you anymore. This is the best way that we can explain these types of shathiyat or silly statements made by Sufis. Now, Bayezid practiced mortification and emptying himself of himself until he had reached, at least for a moment, the world of absolute unity. Of course, this unity with God is not accepted by later Sufis. This is something they say, this is a wrong interpretation of the experiences of the Sufis. Whereas he said, lover, beloved, and love are one. This is, of course, like the I think Attar was very much influenced by Bayezid as well, because this Mantiq al-Tayr of Attar, the Conference of the Verse, I don't know if anyone has read this book, The Conference of the Verse. This is a translation of Mantiq al-Tayr of Attar. He actually believed very much that you come to a station that the lover, the beloved, and the love are the same thing. You cannot differentiate between them. And has anyone read this book, The Conference of the Verse? Yes, you have read it. What he said in this book is very interesting for anyone who wants to read it. He says that once the birds came together and they had a conference, that we want to go and find the biggest bird in this world, Simorgh. Now, Simorgh is a Persian name, of course. Is a Persian word. It is a type of mythical bird, which does not exist, of course, but is the representation of the glory of the bird, or something like that. Now, they wanted to go and find Simorgh. However, of course, many of them disagreed that, no, this is a long journey, we don't want to go, and all these issues. And at the end, some of them agreed that they want to set on this journey. They started the journey, they came through several different big tests and hurdles. And at any place, they started to argue with each other. Some of them returned, some of them died, some of them went forward. Now, at the end of all these, only 30 birds remained that came to the place where Simorgh was living. They came to the search of Simorgh, they came to the place, and they didn't find anything. And it was amazing. After all those toils and troubles and problems, and suddenly they looked at themselves and they saw that they are 30 birds. And in Persian, Simorgh means 30 birds. Si is 30 and bird is morgh. And Simorgh means 30 birds. And they found out that Simorgh were themselves. They were looking for something which were existing in themselves. This is exactly what Bayezid and mystics like him were teaching, that the lover, the beloved, and love are one thing. You just have to unify with it. Now, also, of course, this comes into this mysticism of intoxication. Junaid, the leader of Baghdad school, was his student. Of course, the student was bigger than the teacher. Although he believed that Bayezid did not reach the final goal of the seeker, of the Salikin. Because, as I said, they regarded this type of intoxication as the beginning of the road. There were lots of other stations that they had to follow. Hallaj, his associates, believed that poor Abu Yazid had arrived only at the threshold of the divine. And he was so intoxicated, so excited that he couldn't move further. And it's interesting, many people say the same thing about Hallaj himself, that he had just on the threshold of the divine, he didn't move forward. His name occurred in poetry more than that of any other mystic, Bayezid, with the exception of course, Hallaj, which everyone has heard about. Now, Junaid of Baghdad, of course, is a completely different Sufi. He is the one
You remember we said Sufis had several journeys, and at the end of the first journey they come to annihilation, and then they have to start the second journey, which brings for them baqa after fana, existence after annihilation. This is what actually Junaid found. He moved further than that intoxicated ecstasy of the mystics. Okay, like many other mystics, he came from Iran. As I said, all these mystics came from Iran. And of course he went and lived in Baghdad, that's why he was called Junaid al-Baghdad. He was born in Nahawand, which is very close to my birthplace, Kermanshah. Nahawand is very close to Kermanshah, which is my birthplace. And then settled in Baghdad. And he was educated by his maternal uncle, Sari al-Saqati, who was a great mystic himself. I didn't mention his name because if we wanted to mention all these people, we would have got confused. And was a student of Muhasabi, of whom we of course spoke in details. And then he is regarded as a mild mystic. And the Urafa call him Sayyid al-Ta'ifa. As for example, the jurists call Shaykh al-Tusi Shaykh al-Ta'ifa. The Urafa called Junaid Sayyid al-Ta'ifa. He was the biggest among the Sufis. He even defied wearing a Sufi garment and did not utter theopathic statements, shathiyas. And he emphasized on the state of sobriety, as we mentioned, as contrasted to Bayezid's intoxication. Bayezid preferred mystical intoxication because it obliterates the human attributes and annihilates man completely in God. However, of course, Junaid considered the second sobriety the highest and the preferable state. According to him, after the ecstatic intoxication, man becomes once more aware of himself in the life in God, when all his attributes transformed and ritualized are restored to him. Now, why this difference comes? Because, of course, Bayezid moved towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and stopped at one place. And Junaid was the first one probably that moved more further ahead and found that after this annihilation there is something else. You see, it's just like, for example, you set on a journey to explore what's on the way, and you go say several thousand kilometers, and you say, yes, at the end of this journey there is a river, and everyone thinks that at the end of the world there is a river. However, if there are better equipment, more powerful people, and they can go further ahead, they can say, no, beyond the river there are many, many other things that you haven't seen. This is what was the situation with Junaid of Baghdad, of course. And according to Junaid, fana is not the ultimate goal, but baqa, or remaining, of which we talked, of course, in detail, is a new life in God. He was critical of mystics like Hallaj, who spoke openly about mystical experience and developed instead a language of allusion, isharat, to speak about the subject that makes it unintelligible for the outsiders. And this became a type of custom among all mystics. They speak in a language that other people cannot understand. They understand only themselves. Yes.
Why?
Well, because then they become like Hallaj. I mean, they say things which are very funny if they reveal their experiences. Ordinary people cannot tolerate it. I don't know whether you have heard this hadith that لو علم أبو ذر ما في قلب سلمان لك الفرح. If Abu Dhar knew what is in the heart of Salman, he would have said he is a kafir. Okay? Why? Because the status of Salman was very high in knowledge. And he knew things about God that if he had revealed it, people would have said that he is a kafir. Because ordinary people have a concept about God which cannot digest the further stages and understanding and experiences of God. And usually mystics say, you have this poem of Hafiz, you know why our friend Hallaj was on the gallows, because he revealed the secret, and that was what he deserved. He shouldn't reveal the secret of this
of these experiences. Yes.
I think the hadith and they can confirm it from
Imam Sajjad.
They said that if the Muslims knew, if I said everything I owe, some of the things I know about Allah, the Muslims would
declare
they owe the
declaration. Yeah, Imam Ali actually says this as well. I don't know about the Prophet, but Imam Ali says that. Imam Zain al-Abidin as well says this. Yeah, Imam Zain al-Abidin says that if Muslims know what is going on in my heart about God, they would say I'm a kafir. Of course, I mean, this is very natural because the limit of people's understanding about God is very low. Their understanding is very limited. And if you tell them something which they cannot understand, they cannot digest and analyze, then of course they say they cannot accept it. That's completely, it's just like confusing a child. I mean, why revealing these secrets are not allowed? It's just like if you want to confuse a child about God. It's not good. You shouldn't confuse a child. And these mystics shouldn't confuse us about God. Of course they have high knowledge, but why should they confuse us? We don't understand it, even if they say. So what's the point of saying this? This is why, of course, Junaid was very much against Hallaj saying all those types of things, and he says that he deserved to be, of course, executed because he revealed the secrets. Yes.
Did he exist at the time of Muhammad?
Junaid? No. He died 298. He existed. He was born towards the end of the era of Aima alayhi salam. So his main fruitful life was after the ghiba of Imam al-Asr. Junaid. Yeah. Okay, just one more mystic we want to explore. We come now to a later time, Al-Shaykh Al-Akbar, Muhyiddin ibn Arabi. Of course, it's very difficult to talk about Muhyiddin ibn Arabi because his voluminous type of work on mysticism is very confusing, first of all. Secondly, he has become the Shaykh Al-Akbar for both Shi'i mystics and Sunni mystics, and they regard him as the culmination of the theoretical mysticism and experiences, and he claims many different things which are very, very, very difficult to accept. He claims experiences which are difficult to think that a human being could have had such experiences, an ordinary human being. And just very quickly, I touch upon some aspects of his life. And so he was named Muhyiddin on the order of Abdul Qadir Jilani. Now, this Abdul Qadir Jilani is the Qut, or the head of the Jilaniya tariqah, which is of course a very powerful and important tariqah. And this Abdul Qadir Jilani himself was a great mystic. We will discuss about him when we come to see to Sufi tariqat, inshallah. But when he saw Muhyiddin and he was a child, he somehow found very, very powerful type of understanding of the other world in him. And therefore he called him Muhyiddin and told his father to look after him very carefully. So the name was given to him by Muhyiddin, means the one who revives the religion, of course. And although he, in his autograph notes, he usually signed as Abu Abdullah, of course, for those who read his books. Early day miracles. At the age of 12, the great Shaykh narrates what took place. Now, this is a very interesting. I have brought this, although it's not a great miracle, but I have brought this to mention because sometimes we do things that we do not realize they have what sort of effects. And only if we could see Alam al-Barzakh, we could see the effects of these issues. He says that one day I felt seriously ill and went into a coma, so serious that everyone thought me dead. And then I saw in a vision some horrible looking people who were seeking to hurt me. I noticed a person full of grace and strength breathing out a wonderful perfume which defended me against them and drew them away. Who are you? I asked, and this being replied, I am the Surah Yasin. I am your protector. Then I regained consciousness to find my father, may God have mercy on him, at my bedside in tears, and he had just finished reciting Surah Yasin. Now, of course, this young boy, he was 12, in that coma situation, seeing that, of course, he did not know that his father was reciting Surah Yasin for his cure, and just seeing in that Alamul Barzakh that someone is coming very powerful, with very centered type of breath, is driving away all those horrible creatures, and then he's saying, I am Surah Yasin. It tells us that he was very much connected to Alamul Barzakh and the type of images which are formed there. If you remember, we said anything that we do here has an image in Alamul Barzakh. And this is very much, of course, approved by lots of riwayat and also by the Quran, that these images are formed, although we do not see, we think that it's just words we say. For example, if we tell a lie, or if we start to console a person, it's just words that we utter. However, these have a shape and image in the world of Barzakh according to how we are formed. And those images are real things. As he has seen that this Surah Yasin was a real man coming to protect him. And of course the things that Muhyiddin mentioned in his books shows this very much, that during the whole his life he was completely moving from this world to Barzakh, coming back. He says that I have seen all the prophets, for example, and certainly the prophets live in Barzakh. He says that, for example, I saw the prophet, he gave me a book and told me that write this book, and this is full of hikmah, or something like this. We'll come to this later on. And he was moving. So, no wonder why he became such a great mystic. He had a type of disposition which gave him the power to have these experiences and think. Certainly we cannot have those experiences because we are not so much constituted in the same way to freely move to the world of Barzakh and come. Of course we are different. You see, some people see very fine dreams which come true very, very soon, very quickly. Now, and some people never see dreams at all, for example. This is because some are more connected to Alamul Barzakh, some are less connected. It is not a merit that we are going to be rewarded for it, because it's something which is part of our nature. However, those who are more connected could more easily experience things that other people more difficultly could do. And for Ibn Arabi, the way he has introduced himself and the way he has theorized all these issues, and no one after him has been able to improve on what he said, it shows that he had that sort of disposition and constitution which was different from others. Now, inspirations. Ibn Arabi claimed that he wrote through inspiration. This you can see through all his. He usually writes, these I do not write on my own accord. These are what I am inspired to write. And that's why he had lots and lots of enemies. Even in Iran now, you can see that he's the most loved among some, the most hated among some, because of his claims. His claims are totally unbelievable for some people. He authored many great books which, according to him, originated from divine inspiration. The mystical experiences he went through in life were his inspirations to write, often attempting to explain those experiences. And it's very interesting that he said, whatever I say and whatever I'm inspired are just understandings from the verses of the Quran. And I have nothing beyond the Quran. It's all, an understanding that Allah has given to me, that I understand different things and I experience the ta'wil of all these verses. Maybe. And he, for example, now example of these, his voluminous book, Al-Futuhat al-Makkiyah, the Meccan Illuminations, while he was in Mecca, he has some futuhat. Usually the mystics call the highest experiences of the supernatural futuhat, the openings of the Khan, or the victories, or the illuminations, anything like that. Now, it is an encyclopedic work founded on the Quran and discussion of Islamic wisdom viewed from the perspective of the stages of the mystic path. However, he mentions that, I mean, the stories he mentions in this are amazing. He was given many parts of this book from different prophets, for example. And, of course, many people have relied on them because they have found them somehow similar to their experiences, to their own experiences. And all these issues about Asma'ullah, the names of Allah, the attributes of Allah, and the experience of Allah, have originated from Ibn Arabi. Before him, of course, we have it in the Ahadith of A'imma, but no one had experienced and had theorized it. I was reading a book by Allama Tabatabai about Asma'ullah. I was so amazed by this, that how this man has this knowledge about Asma'ullah and how has he analyzed it. Then I read Fusus al-Hakam of Ibn al-Arabi. I saw that he had taken it all from Ibn al-Arabi. And of course, he doesn't say that I have originated it, because Allama Tabatabai was very much fond of Ibn al-Arabi and he was completely emphasizing everywhere that all these knowledge have come from Ibn al-Arabi. And even I was reading something last night, I don't know what it was, from Ayatollah Hassan Zada Amuli, he mentioned that Allama Tabatabai was saying that all these I have learned from Ibn al-Arabi. Now, I mention this because what is said about Ibn al-Arabi is so unbelievable that you cannot think that someone like Allama Tabatabai would say that I have gained knowledge from Ibn al-Arabi. However, the experiences that Allama Tabatabai had match very much with whatever Ibn al-Arabi had theorized. And it's amazing. And it's not for us to judge, because it needs someone who has the experience and then goes to the book and see how they have theorized it. And also he had Fusus al-Hikam, the bezels of wisdom. This, he says, he received directly from the Prophet Muhammad, peace be on him, who appeared to him in Damascus in a dream in the year 1129-627. And he told him, this is the book, Fusus al-Hakam, take it to the people. And he woke up, and then he found out that he had the knowledge of this book in his heart. And he started to write the book. Of course, the book, if you read it, you don't understand anything from it. It's just written in a secret language, in a way that only the mystics can understand it, or those who have some of these experiences and have previous knowledge about it. However, this is his claim. He says, I received it directly from the Prophet. He gave me the book in dream. I woke up and had the whole book in my heart, and I wrote it down. And, well, is this possible? Do not. He has authored more than 800 books. Now, you can see how, of course, he was very busy with his followers, with his journeys, and it's amazing how he found all this time to write all these books. And, of course, Othman Yahya has listed his bibliography in two big volumes in French, of course. And you can imagine two big volumes of books of only one person, how hugely he has worked on this. One of his works is an interpretation of the Quran in 90 volumes, of course not published. It's just mentioned in old books. We cannot find it now at the moment. He influenced many, many mystics after himself. And especially the type of mysticism that we have in Iran today is very much influenced by Ibn al-Arabi, as I said. Allama Tabatabai,
Ayatollah Hasanzade, and their teachers of teachers were all influenced by this school of Ibn Arabi. Some of greatest characters known to us were influenced by Ibn Arabi. Jalaluddin al-Rumi, the author of Masnavi, who was connected to Ibn Arabi via Sadruddin al-Qunyawi, who was the disciple of the latter and friend and close associate of the other. And Alauddin Samnani, the formidable mystic of the 7th century who criticized Ibn Arabi, also admits he was greatly influenced by him. And Sheikh Muhammad al-Lahiji, founder of Nur Bakhshi Sufi Order, and many others. Many others were influenced by Ibn Arabi. Shah Ni'matullah Wali, founder of Ni'matullah Sufi Order, he was also influenced by deeply by Ibn Arabi. And his influences are not limited to Sufi Shaykhs and Orders. He also influenced great Shiites, Gnostics, such as Sayyid Haydar Amuli, who wrote a commentary and work based on Ibn Arabi's theoretical Irfan, and also the whole bunch of Shi'i mystics, contemporary Shi'i mystics. And not only that, he influenced Shi'i philosophers like Mullah Sadra, Sadruddin Shirazi. And actually Sadruddin Shirazi says that his Hikmat al-Muta'aliya is a rationalization of the theoretical Irfan of Ibn Arabi. Now Ibn Arabi, was he a Shi'i or a Sunni? Well, it's difficult to say that he was a Shi'i. And it's difficult to say that he was a Sunni. He had his own experience of reality, actually. And he had great respect for A'imma alayhi salam, for example. Great respect for Imam Ali. But still, he had great respect for Abu Bakr and Umar as well. It's very confusing, very perplexing and it seems that these realities could not be found by mystical experience. It's very difficult. Mystical experience is only about the world of God, not about the world of human beings and what they do in this world. It's very, very dodgy somehow. You cannot say that since a person is very mystical, has lots of miracles, lots of karamat, and if he's a Sunni, then Sunni faith is right, or if he's a Shi'i, then Shi'i faith is right. It's not possible to say that. This Sunni-Shi'i business should only be solved by rational arguments rather than by experiences. And amazingly, those critics of Ibn Arabi say that why Shi'i mystics follow Ibn Arabi? While, for example, in one of his statements in Futuhat, he says that there are some group of people who are called Rajabiyun, who fast all the Rajab, and they are the people who are described by the Prophet those who receive the blessings of Rajab. And they say that I met some of these Rajabiyun, and some of them explained for me that they saw Shi'as in form of pigs. Now, of course, this is very irritating, and we have some mystics in Mashhad. The last time we went there, we saw one of those mystics. No, not mystics, ulama, of course, in Mashhad, who are very critical of Ibn Arabi, and critical of Allama Tabatabai, and critical of Hasanzada Amuli, that why do you follow Ibn Arabi? He says that the Rajabiyun saw Shi'as in form of pigs. And why do you say that Ibn Arabi was a Shi'i or Ibn Arabi was respectable? Now, okay, how can we explain this? Yeah, we can explain this that maybe those Shi'as were Fasaq of Shi'a, for example. They were sinful Shi'as. It was not because they were Shi'as that they saw them in form of pigs, but because they were sinful people, they saw them in form of pigs. But, however, he was not very much revealing his attitude towards Shi'ism or Sunnism. Yeah.
We have in Hadith about a quarter of the verses in the Holy Quran are about Ahlul Bayt. I think is it one quarter or something like that? Mm-hmm. A fraction is given. So if Ibn Arabi says that his knowledge is all coming from the Quran, how does
he had great respect for Ahlul Bayt. Great respect for Imam al-As as well. He believed in someone like Imam al-As. Of course, people say he only talks about Khatam al-Awliya or Khatam al-Usiya, but he's talking about himself, not Imam al-As. Sometimes his statements are very confusing, and that's why people are left in this status of not knowing what really was the idea of Ibn al-Arabi about
Walaya and about because the topic of Walaya is very important in mysticism. But they see the Walaya not only as Walaya of A'imma, they see the Walaya as Walaya of Qus, as well, Walaya of the mystics as well. So I don't know, it's very difficult to judge. However, what I'm trying to stress is that his experiences and the way he theorized this matched with the experiences of many other mystics, and they found no better language than the language of Ibn Arabi to explain it, and therefore they are very much fond of using Ibn Arabi's statements rather than any other mystic, despite of course his insult to Shi'ism, for example, or despite some of the arguments that Sunnis would not accept. You know, he was very much attacked by Ibn Taymiyyah, for example, claiming that he has destroyed the religion or something like that. And they said that he was influenced by Shi'is, for example, in many of his ideas that he was saying. It's difficult to judge such situations, really. Now, as well as influencing the Ismaili Shi'ites, who chiefly refer to the Quranic commentary of Ibn Arabi. Yes.
This thing about seeing the Shia speak, wasn't there a reply to this?
Well, the only reply is that those Shias might be the Fasaq of Shia.
No, I heard another reply. I thought you called it. Maybe somebody else did. That maybe when a person reaches a very certain level, he becomes a mirror of God.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, if you a mirror, and they say, if you saw the mistake, maybe you were looking at yourself.
You can't say this to Ibn Arabi, of course. This is very difficult to say this to Ibn Arabi.
somebody actually did reply this to him.
Hmm.
But
these are those critics of Ibn Arabi, of course, attacking very, very severely for what he has done and for what he has said. Now, so he played a pivotal role in the creation of the school of Hikmah, without which great personalities would never have the opportunity to become what they have. Personalities such as Mullah Sadra, as I mentioned, all his Hikmatul Muta'aliyah is something which is actually rationalization of his mystical theories. Mullah Ali Nuri, Mullah Hadi Sabzawari, the great Shi, of course, philosopher, and Imam Khomeini. Yeah. Now, Imam Khomeini, of course, one of the things he mentioned to Gorbachev in his lecture, that why don't you let your people in Russia go and read the books of Ibn Arabi and know about the true face of Islam and the reality of religion. Now, of course, after he wrote that letter to Gorbachev, lots of articles were going around criticizing Ibn Arabi and then criticizing Imam Khomeini. Why Imam Khomeini talks about Ibn Arabi and why he says that Gorbachev should encourage people to go and read Ibn Arabi's book, bringing these examples that he mentioned some people saw Shia in form of fiqh and many other things that I don't remember now. If you want to quote, for example, he has things about Abu Bakr and Umar. He says that once I had a vision, I saw Abu Bakr at the right hand of Allah, Umar at the left hand, and Ali sitting down, lower than them, which completely, of course, is against Shi'i thought. But this is how he says these things. How can we explain it? Well, what you saw was wrong. This was reflection of your theology, for example. As I said, you cannot 100% accept someone or 100% reject it. Certainly, he had something valuable in what he wrote in his experiences. However, when it comes to Shi'is, the Shi'is will say, well, of course, not all the visions, because the vision you construe in your mind according to what you already know, according to your theology. And what you saw might not have been in the same order as you saw. It just was created due to the type of theology in which you believe. So, this is how it is. And this is not my fault. It is the way it has been. Now, the controversies, although he was considered a great personality by many scholars to the extent that they called him
Waliyul Kamil, the perfect saint, and Qutbul Aqtab, the pole of the poles. He also had his opponents who referred to him as Mumituddin, the killer of the faith. Instead of Muhyiddin, the reviver of the faith, they called him Mumituddin, or Mahiddin, the effacer of the faith. And all these are written in different books. Last time I was in Iran, I saw two very interesting books. I hope I remember the name, because the names are very interesting. One two-volume book was written by one of the students of Allama Tabatabai, of Allama Tabatabai, Faslul, Al-Kalamul Mateen fi Tashayyu'u Muhyiddin. Okay. The powerful statement in the Tashayyu of Muhyiddin ibn Arabi. And he had tried in two volumes to prove that Ibn Arabi was a Shi'i, not a Sunni. And then I saw another book, it was something like this, but it was the final word in that Ibn Arabi was a Sunniyun. Ibn Arabi Sunniyun Mutaassir. He was a very prejudiced Sunni. And it's interesting, both of them had actually provided arguments that the one from different parts of Ibn Arabi's book that he was a Shi'i, the other from other parts of Ibn Arabi's book that he was a Sunni. And of course, the one we shouldn't be unjust, the one who had mentioned that he was Sunni and Mutaassib, his arguments were much, much more powerful than the other one. The other one was a very weak book. Anyhow, this is how it is. And now, one thing, of course, of Ibn Arabi has remained to discuss, which I'm a bit hesitant to discuss it or not, that's his theory of Wahdatul Wujud. You know, this theory of Wahdatul Wujud has come from Ibn Arabi. He has theorized it. Others had, of course, some sort of shathiyat about it, theopathic statements, or some sort of allusions to it, but they could not theorize it very well as Ibn Arabi had theorized it. Now, just a glance, okay? The theory of Wahdatul Wujud. Now, we had different opinions about the existence. Now, just I mentioned what are those differences, and then we would see what Wahdatul Wujud means. One theory is Kathratul Wujud wal Mawjud, diversity of the existence and the existent. Usually peripatetic philosophers, Masha'in, like Aristotle, they believed in this, that you have all types of beings. You have God, as you have the universe, as you have the sun, as you have the earth, as you have animals. All these are separate beings. As Allah is a separate being, these things are separate beings as well. However, this is very difficult to understand, how one being can be actually outside the realm of Allah. Is there anything there outside the realm of Allah? So this was the main idea of Masha'in philosophers. There are lots of wujudat, of course, and lots of mawjudat. Mawjudat had their own wujud. The different beings had their own existence, their own separate existence. This is one thing. The other was that unity of the existence and diversity of the existence. Existence means mawjud, existence means wujud. Okay? What it means, there is one existence, and all other beings are mahiyat. They are just beings, of course, which take their existence from that one big existence, okay? Attributed to the existence. This is possible according to essentiality of Mahiyya. Now, we don't go to this. This is what Ishraqiyun, the illuminationist philosophers, had actually proposed. Now, what is the difference between this one and the previous one? In this one, you say that there is one existence.
There is only one existence in this world, and that's God. Okay. However, there are different mahiyat which take their existence from that one existence. Their existent status from that one existence. In the previous one, Kathratul Wujud wal Mujud, you didn't have one big existence and then everything else gaining their existence from that one. Everyone had their own independent existence. However, God had one big existence and had created other existences. Is that clear or not?
There's something like according to the
other cause. Yeah, he is the cause and other existences. You see, in the second theory there is no other existence. There are existent beings which have their existence taken from that one big existence. In the first theory, there is one big existence, an existence which actually causes other existences to come. They are different, independent. Okay, this is another theory about the diversity and unity of existence. The third one, Wahdatul Wujud wal Mawjud, unity of the existence and the existent, despite their diversity. This is the Mullah Sadras and all Persian philosophers before Islam, Pahlaviyun. Actually, Mullah Sadras draws on philosophical ideas of Persian Hikmah before Islam very much, because they were also probably influenced by Platonic ideas. So he says there is one wujud and there is one mawjud. There are not different mawjudat, there is only one mawjud. There is only one existent being. However, that existent being, although the existence is unique, however it has different ranks from strong to weak. The Pahlaviyun, the old Persian philosophers, they had this parable of simulating the existence of God and the creation to light. They said, we have big lights, that's the light of sun, and we have small lights. But all of them are lights, there's nothing else. It's just one existence, and one existent being. However, the light has different levels of strength and enormity. So you have the very strong one, the weak one. It's all one light that has been actually graded into different grades. And this comes due to some limitations. Of course, I will explain this later on. And the fourth theory is unity of existence, theory of the mystics, of course, of Ibn Arabi. There is only the existence and all the existent beings are but its different manifestations and states and specifications, مظاهر وشؤون وتعيينات. Now, it is very difficult to understand what it means. But I want to ask you a question. I want you to think about it. When God creates, where is that creation? Is it outside God? Is it a new existence that previously did not exist in God? Is it something in addition to God? Or is it something which were already there? Which one? Anyone you say, I would pose another question to you. It's a very difficult dilemma. Yes?
I think that everything already has existed in the eternal knowledge of Allah. Mm-hmm. And so what he's doing is just manifesting what was possible.
Okay, it existed in the eternal knowledge, but when it brings it to the world of existence, what brings about? What comes about? What is it that God brings about? It is something outside Him, separate from Him, apart?
Yes. So, when you think of a thought, where is that thought? I mean, our existence in relation to Allah is like the existence of a thought in relation to a reality.
Yeah.
Where is your thought? Is it outside yourself? It's so dependent on you that if you stop thinking about it, it doesn't exist anymore.
So we are not independent existent beings or independent type of existence. We are just right as you said, it is a type of shu'ul, manifestations of what is in the world of gods, which has shown itself in this way. Is this what you are saying? This is almost what actually the theory of Wahdat al-Wujud wants to say. It says that you cannot say that there is anything beside God. Of course, you cannot say that this is different from pantheism, because the pantheistic theories say that God is sum total of whatever exists in this universe. Okay, so if you put all the creation together, it's God, because there couldn't be anything outside God. However, this is completely, completely different from this theory. And this is why Ibn Arabi always speaks in paradoxical way. He says, whatever you see is God, is not God. It's different from God, of course. It doesn't mean that, of course, we do not exist at all. But how we are related to God? Now, the mystics say you cannot understand this theory of Wahdat al-Wujud except through experience. And if you don't have mystical experiences, you cannot. It's very, very difficult to understand this theory of Wahdat al-Wujud. Yes, you want to say something? Mullah Sadra wanted to come close to this theory of Wahdat al-Wujud and rationalize it, but it was very difficult to rationalize. Very difficult to rationalize. So he came very close to it by this theory of Tashkik, the different ranks of existence, which are all actually the dependent aspects of one big existence. Now, they say that how the creation comes about. They say that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in His eternal decision for creation, created some sort of ashbah, some sort of beings which did not exist at all. It was just some plan, so to speak, some imagination in the mind, okay? And these ashbah had their own limits. These ashbah, some of them were like human beings, some of them were like angels, and of course it was a quite organized type of world, but it did not exist. It was just some sort of something between being and not being. Then, of course, He gave them existence from that source of eternal existence that He has. So, when you look at these, when you look at me, certainly I'm not God, I'm not a part of God. Because, and those limitations which were at the beginning eternally planned by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, I have come to existence due to what? To my relation to Him. Due to that relationship, existence relationship. I have gained existence from Him. But it's only one existence. I have gained existence from Him. And this is the meaning of La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah. This is the meaning that nothing exists beside God, beside Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, is this understandable at all? No. It is difficult to understand. It's only understandable for those who come to such an experience that, like Hallaj or like Bayazid, they say there is nothing but God. They come to that state, they see that there is nothing but God. It's all madahir and shu'un and ta'ayyunat, just limitations, manifestations, states, specifications that Allah has given to that big existence. And still, as Imam Ali says, He is with everything, but He is not with anything. He is different from everything, but He is not away from anything. And this paradoxical thing, هو الأول والآخر والظاهر والباطن, He is the manifest, He is the hidden. You see His manifestations, but He is not He. He is completely hidden. And this is not understood but through those experiences. And this is what actually Ibn Arabi gave to the world of mysticism, this theory of relationship between God and His creation, which is the theory of Wahdat al-Wujud. Yeah.
But this theory was already there from
Imam. It was not theorized as such. He theorized it very, very clearly, actually. It was there, yes. But
It was in the Quran. Huwa al-zahir wa al-batin. This is, of course, well, we say it was in the Quran because now we say this means wahdat al-wujud. Of course, before that, people didn't say that this means wahdat al-wujud. They didn't understand it in this way. It was Ibn Arabi who actually theorized it in this way. Yes.
Weren't you just explaining it on in your lecture on Najib al-Ada?
Yeah.
Well, that means it was in Imam Ali's time and not even so far away.
Yeah, this is what I said. I mean, just the statement I made was the translation of that statement of Nahjul Balagha, okay? But it was there, but it was not theorized, it was not found as a theory, okay? It was just a statement that people couldn't analyze. They couldn't actually explain, alright? Now, after Ibn Arabi, they explained it in the light of this theory of Wahdat al-Wujud very clearly. They say this is actually referring to what Ibn Arabi mentioned in his theory of Wahdat al-Wujud. Any other question? Yes. Sorry. Yes.
Is it like they believe that everything in this world is an illusion? It's not real.
No, it's not illusion. It's more real than you think. But it's real, but it is a manifestation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this manifestation is very real. It's not illusion. However, it's not separate from God. Still, it's not God. It's very, very difficult to understand. Our minds cannot understand it because it's not set to understand. It's only through the heartfelt experience that this theory could be understood. And this is what Ibn Arabi himself says. He says, you never can rationalize this theory. It is above the Tawr al-Aql. What he mentioned is his exact expression is Tawr al-Aql. It's above the rank of reason. You cannot, by reason, grasp it. It's only something that you can experience, and that's all.
There is different things like non-philosophical.
Well, that's philosophical. This is mystical. That's completely different. Yeah, this is a mystical theory. Yes.
Maybe it's a similar question. How does this relate to the way it's related in the divine image and reflections of the divine spirit? How does that involve the divine?
Reflection of God in what, sorry?
In terms.
Of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Well, even human beings who are actually whose soul can be a reflection of the attributes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, still are they the same or they are different? I mean, whatever you mention, we can ask this question. Are they the same as Allah or they are different from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? You could not say that they are the same. You could not say that they are different. You have to grasp something in the middle which could not be understood by reason. It's something that could only be experienced. Okay, inshallah.